From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And today, House Democrats have released transcripts of the testimony given by former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, and former State Department official Michael McKinley. We will be following that. But meanwhile, a top lawyer for the National Security Council, John Eisenberg, is a no-show today for a scheduled deposition on Capitol Hill, defying a subpoena and escalating the White House's legal battle with congressional Democrats. Eisenberg is a key witness for the impeachment inquiry. He reportedly was instrumental in locking down the transcript of President Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president by moving it to a top secret server. So let's learn more about who Eisenberg is and his role in this whole saga. Tom Hamburger is an investigative political reporter for The Washington Post. And Tom, last week, Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine advisor at the White House, testified that he listened in on that call where President Trump asked the president of Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. And Vindman said he raised concerns to the White House's top national security lawyer, John Eisenberg. What was Eisenberg's response, according to your reporting?
So what we learned about Colonel Vindman's testimony to the House impeachment investigators is this. He was alarmed as he listened in to President Trump's call with Ukraine's president on July 25, so unnerved that he went immediately after listening to the call to see John Eisenberg, the White House legal advisor on national security, to tell him that what the president did was wrong, that it seemed to be violating U.S. policy and seemed to be seeking personal political favors from a foreign leader. He testified that he went to Eisenberg's office because he was alarmed by what he had heard on the call. And the only response that he offered during the meeting right after the call was that the rough transcript of the call, the summary of the call, should be placed in an unusual spot, that is, the highly classified top secret vault, usually reserved for documents that would reveal sources and methods for U.S. intelligence and military operations, not for presidential call transcripts. In fact, we're told it's unheard of or virtually unheard of for such a call to be placed on a classified server like that. Mm-hmm. So that was one step. Another was a couple of days after the conversation, Eisenberg approached Vindman again and said, "I'd like you not to talk to anybody about what we discussed and what you observed in the call." Again, by itself, perhaps there's an innocuous explanation for this, but in combination with a couple of other factors that we're talking about here, it seemed to some as though it was part of a pattern or could have been part of a pattern or an effort to conceal or bury the substance of the president's conversation with his counterpart in Ukraine.
You also write that by the time Vindman came to Eisenberg in late July, Eisenberg was already familiar with concerns among White House officials about the administration's attempts to pressure Ukraine for political purposes. What did he know, and why is this important to note?
Eisenberg was aware of concerns from the National Security Staff because a couple of weeks earlier, on July 10, President Zelensky had sent a delegation of Ukrainian officials to the White House to try to shore up relations with the U.S. They couldn't figure out why it seemed there was a delay in getting a face-to-face meeting set up between the newly elected president and President Trump. And there were some concerns about whether legally mandated a military aid would be flowing to the Ukraine. And so they came to the White House, these two emissaries, on July 10 and had a meeting with the National Security Council staff, but also with three other individuals. One is a special envoy appointed by President Trump, Mr. Sondland. Another was Energy Secretary Rick Perry. And the third was a special envoy to Ukraine, Volker. And in the course of meeting with this group, those three, led by Sondland, seemed to be pushing a request for assistance and getting information that might be helpful to the president politically. Hmm. The conversation was a bit subtle, but it so alarmed John Bolton in this meeting that they had on July 10 that he quickly called it to a close. And then he later asked one of his associates, the national security advisor for Ukraine, to report what was observed to the legal office. And so the place that those Bolton advisors went was, once again, John Eisenberg. So on July 10, there was the first warning of an executive branch effort, this time not involving the president personally, but involving some of his top appointees, to seemingly introduce a question of seeking political favors from the new Ukrainian administration as a condition for getting a meeting with the president or getting needed aid.
Has Eisenberg or his lawyer responded to any of this?
Eisenberg has so far declined to comment, and the White House has declined to comment. The response that we have is really the response that is sort of visible today on Capitol Hill, which is where impeachment investigators hoped John Eisenberg would be sitting to answer questions. There will be an empty chair. Eisenberg is another of several figures at the top level of advisors to the president who are declining to respond to subpoenas and requests to testify in this impeachment inquiry. And so he is one of these figures who is now part of this constitutional drama that we're witnessing between the demands of the legislative branch and the claims of special privilege by the White House and the Office of the President.
And those other folks, Michael Ellis, also of the National Security Council, as well as Robert Blair and Brian McCormick of the White House Office of Management and Budget, they're all skipping this meeting, as you said, these meetings. What will the Democrats do next now that these folks have decided not to testify?
So there are others who are facing requests to testify who are even more senior. One is John Bolton, who resigned recently as National Security Advisor. He, remember, is the guy who is at the top of this national security establishment. And in a sense, the buck stops with him. He would be a critically important witness, and his testimony is considered vital.
So much to follow. That's Tom Hamburger, investigative political reporter for The Washington Post. Tom, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Well, tomorrow is election day in many states. There are three gubernatorial elections in Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And control of the state legislature is on the line in Virginia, where Democrats are trying to take power for the first time since 1995. Both major parties have poured millions of dollars and star power into the races there. Ben Pavier of member station VPM has our story from Richmond.
The scene outside this suburban Richmond home looks like the setup to a joke. There's a knock on a door, and who's there but actor Alec Baldwin, a Democratic politician, and a pack of reporters.
Hi.
How are you?
Are you Christine?
I am Kristen.
Kristen.
Amanda.
Baldwin impersonates President Trump on Saturday Night Live, but he's here on Kristen Goodlett's doorstep to give some Hollywood-level press to Virginia's off-off-year elections.
These people are following us.
Hey, guys.
We don't know where they came. We don't know what they want.
Baldwin's stumping for Democratic State Senate candidate Amanda Pohl. She's running in a district that leans red. If Democrats win here, they have a good chance of capturing the legislature and passing new policies on their priorities.
About health care and gun control and women's rights. You know that
for candidates like Pohl, half the battle is reminding people that there's an important election this year.
This is an off-off-year election. We need as many people to know that there's an election and that they need to come out and vote.
To pull it off, the Democratic Party and liberal groups are running a coordinated campaign. Their candidates have raised record amounts of money, $32 million by the end of September, compared to $22 million for Republicans. And they've brought in big names. Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris have all made Virginia pit stops. Singer Jason Mraz, who's from outside Richmond, even made songs for a couple of candidates.
Go Deborah, go Deborah.
10 years ago, it was Republicans who were all in on state elections. They launched Red Map, a project to win state legislatures and use that power to redraw legislative maps in their favor. It worked. Jessica Post remembers watching the GOP flip 11 state houses in 2010.
I curled up on the ground after leaving a smoky bar, and I let the rain fall down on me, and I thought about what we could do to take back state legislatures in 2020.
Post now leads the National Democratic Party's efforts to do just that. Virginia's just their first stop. They think they can flip at least a dozen states next year, including places like Georgia and Texas. The winners there will get to draw new congressional and state legislative districts for the next decade.
And so going into the 2020 cycle, we have a generational opportunity to flip legislatures red to blue during a presidential year and to undo the Republican rigging of maps nationwide.
Last year, a federal court threw out a dozen Republican-drawn districts here for racial gerrymandering. Post says Democrats are committed to fair mapping, but Republicans are skeptical. At a rally in Virginia Beach on Saturday, Vice President Mike Pence said it was Democrats who were out to gerrymander. And he said Republicans were the last defense against radical Democratic policies.
And Virginians know. Virginians know it was freedom, not socialism, that gave us the most prosperous and powerful nation in the history of the world. It was freedom.
Only one Democratic candidate here identifies as a socialist, and the president isn't all that popular here. Virginia is the only state in the South that he lost in 2016. Still, at his rally, Pence repeatedly connected elections here to the presidential contest next year.
We're going to set the stage for Virginia to vote to give President Donald Trump 4 more years in the White House. Those are the stakes.
Democrats hope that it sends a different message. One last rebuke of Trump before next year's presidential vote. For NPR News, I'm Ben Pavier in Richmond.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
In 1987, dozens of federal agents surrounded a trailer park in Ozark, Missouri. Their target, a white supremacist threatening violent revolution.
I have 8 teams of freedom fighters prepared to start a race war nationwide.
The agents fired tear gas, arrested him, and found a massive arsenal.
C4 plastic explosives, hand grenades, thousands of rounds of ammunition.
So, years later, why did the FBI stop watching him? That story on Embedded from NPR.
You might recognize comedian Nick Offerman for his role as Ron Swanson, the macho and libertarian parks director on NBC's Parks and Recreation.
Under my tutelage, you will grow from boys into men, from men into gladiators, and from gladiators into Swansons.
Or maybe you know him from the commercials he did for Sling TV with his wife, Will and Grace star Megan Mullally.
We're slingers.
You heard that right, boss. We sling.
Hey, kids. Want to sling with us?
The freedom is exhilarating.
Woo!
Nick. Well, this fall, Offerman is touring the country with a new stand-up comedy show called All Rise, in which he tells jokes and sings a number of original songs. Nick Offerman joins me now in the studio. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
And we should point out at the beginning, you're not Ron Swanson, even though you look like him.
Well,
sound like him.
Yeah, I'm working with the same toolbox. But yeah, he's much more brilliantly written than I am, unfortunately.
Now, you call this show a revival. And at the beginning, you say you want to avoid the low-hanging fruit of the current political climate.
That's right.
Why?
Because I feel like the national mood and really the global mood in the places I've been touring is that things are dire. Things are fraught. And we're all worried. I'm worried and I'm astonished at the misbehavior of our supposed leaders. And so the last thing I want to do is remind the audience of that situation. And so I try to instead poke fun at what it is about humanity that has gotten us in this trouble without actually focusing on the specific trouble.
And poke fun at masculinity.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that comes up a great deal. Ron Swanson, my character from Parks and Rec, was considered very masculine. I'm often accused of masculinity. And, you know, I was born looking like this and I sound like this. You know, I did not cultivate, I don't go to the gym. I'm not chasing masculinity. And so it's always seemed a little strange to me as a mincing theater artist to be accused of being manly. I am pretty handy at splitting firewood or changing a tire, but so are the women in my family. And so I use it as an opportunity to encourage people to try and loosen their ideas about genderizing everything. I know ladies that are great woodworkers, and I know men that make an amazing quiche, and everything across every spectrum in between.
What does it mean to you to be a man?
Well, gosh. to me, it means standing up for one's principles first and foremost. It means being true to your word and having good manners and pursuing decency. It doesn't mean, you know, getting in a fist fight or any of the habits that are associated with misogyny. I think good manners and the sensitivity to show one's emotions are something that's much more manly and require more bravery than acts of violence or feats of physical strength.
Well, and we said that you say you don't want to go after the political humor so much, but you do to some degree in your show. You talk about gun ownership, for one thing.
Yeah, it's hard to get around when there's low-hanging fruit on the ground.
Gotta eat
sometimes
it.
You step on it, yeah. I mean, the gun thing is baffling to me. In my show, I simply say I personally would be terrified of having a gun because I, like everyone else in the world, am stupid. I don't need a gun. And so don't give me – like I also don't need a chainsaw around the house. So don't give me one, you know, that my kid can maybe play with. Those things are dangerous.
Do you think that sometimes people come to your show and – are surprised by your humor? Maybe they think they're coming to see Ron Swanson.
Yeah, I think there is a small percentage of the audience that sadly is not very good at watching television. I've had people get quite angry with me when they come to learn that Parks and Rec was not a documentary. And I try to be gentle with them because I want them to hear what I have to say, and I'm interested and respectful of what they have to say. But yeah, it's a funny thing when people see a cleverly written comedy character and are somehow able to extrapolate a real-life personal heroism from that.
What are you watching on TV now? What do you like, especially in the comedy side of things?
Well, the thing that leaps to mind, a couple British series recently, Catastrophe and Fleabag.
Fleabag, right. Just won a bunch of Emmys.
Yeah. My wife is an incredible creative director in our household, and she does the picking for almost everything in our lives. And it's great. It takes so much off my plate. I don't have to keep up with anything. I say, what are we watching now? She says, this show called Fleabag. So we were both Fleabag and Succession. We were on board because of her acumen immediately, like a year before before the world was like, hey, this is amazing. We were like, yeah.
How does she influence your comedy?
Well, she's actually directing this comedy show.
Uh-huh.
So she directly influences it by me saying, honey, please come see my show and tell me what to cut and what to improve. She affects it. I mean, we're just collaborators. I mean, we love to see each other work, and then we love knowing one another's strengths and weaknesses. We then love to say, hey, you're doing that funny voice. You don't have to do that when you're playing that one bit. That's how she directly affects it. She indirectly affects it because I think I'm usually trying to make someone laugh when I'm chasing comedy. Either it's Megan or my best friend or like my siblings or my cousin growing up. But these days, you know, last 20 years, it's usually Megan. Like if I was to do something right now to try and make you laugh, mm-hmm. I'm really trying to make her laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that tool set. And so she's not only my wife and my best friend, but she's my teacher in a lot of ways. She's also just a comedy legend. She's like a walking Mel Brooks movie. And so it's, you know, it'd be silly and masculine of me to not take advantage of the fact that my wife is a champion in the very sport that I try to mm-hmm. excel at.
Okay, I want to ask you one more thing before we ask you to play a song for us. And that is, you went to college in my hometown of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois.
I did.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Oh, sure. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s in small town Illinois, and it was very much a cultural vacuum. And when I got to Champaign-Urbana, to my first college town, it blew my mind. It was so incredibly formative. Quite specifically, the theater department, the facility called the Krannert Center, But then even more specifically, there was a teacher named Shozo Sato who taught this whole program of Japanese arts, and he created this thing called Japan House, which is still there. You can learn tea ceremony and Zen meditation in a Japanese garden-like setting. So it's like a park with a bridge over a pond. And that's just one of the jewels of this great university, you know. That was incredibly eye-opening to me to say, oh, wow, culture is everywhere. And I
can still smell the cows just a mile away.
Absolutely. There is that. It's got a charming fecundity to it. But I just had an amazing time, and I think I never would have, you know, become whatever success that I've had has a lot to do with what I learned in that town and the time I had there.
Okay, well, now that you've talked about a Japanese garden and a tea ceremony, I think this is a perfect opportunity for you to play your song, I'm Not Ron Swanson.
Very well, yes. Now that I've set up a temple-like atmosphere, let me destroy that. Most of my songs, I want to say, are written with a guy who played around here for a lot of his life named Mark Rivers. I don't have the talent to write this music, so I write most of the words, and then he comes up with... And he always writes the best joke in every song. I understand you've come to love another man. He's studly and heroic, so I completely understand. But now your expectations are a little high, I fear. 'Cause if I had to live like him, I'd be dead within a year. So he can eat a big-ass steak for every single meal. 'Cause his colon is fictitious, while mine is all too real. And his scotch intake, well, it would be my liver's doom. 'Cause mine is controlled by nature, and his by the whims of the writer's room. I'm not Ron Swanson. Hear me shout it from sea to sea, from Texas to Wisconsin. He only lives in your goddamn TV. I'm not Don Draper or Gomer Pyle, and I'm certainly not the Fonz. Please understand, these are my own mortal hands, not Ron's. Flawless.
Flawless. Nick Offerman, thank you so much for coming in and for singing for us, too.
My pleasure. There's no accounting for taste.
That is comedian Nick Offerman, who is currently touring the country with his show All Rise. You can find more information about where to see him at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Gullah Geechee people have lived along the southern U.S. coast for centuries. They are direct descendants of slaves who managed to hold on to much of their African heritage. They even have their own distinct language. But now, their way of life and unique culture are at risk. South Carolina Public Radio's Victoria Hansen reports.
Just south of Charleston, on the sea island of St. Helena, you can still hear the quiet. Fish belly flop along the marsh. As the sun begins its fiery descent, behind billowy tufts of cattails.
My childhood was magical.
Victoria Smalls grew up on the island, one of 14 children who helped farm the family's land. The area had been home to dozens of plantations where her ancestors were enslaved. Once freed, they stayed on the remote island, maintaining and protecting their African traditions. Their descendants, and others like them who lived isolated, from Florida to North Carolina, became known as Gullah Geechee.
Gullah Geechee means that you have most of your Africanisms intact, more than any other African American in America.
Smalls works at the island's Penn Center, the first school in the South for freed slaves. Part of the center's mission now is preserving Gullah Geechee communities. Roughly 1 million descendants still live along the southeast coast. The concern these days? Climate change. Rising sea levels threaten to swallow hallowed Gullah land.
How do you sustain a culture that's so tied to ancestral land? We have to start preparing for that now.
But preparing means sharing a culture long considered sacred.
So where we would rather not talk to folks, unless we've been to crack we teeth with we family and think on the porch and things like that or the piazza, but we have to do it.
Marquetta Goodwine, better known as Queen Ket, is the official spokesperson for Gullah Geechee Nation, making sure its people are not displaced. She says they have fought off developers and warned about climate change.
The government officials paid us no mind, just considered us, quote, emotional natives, end quote.
She says ocean acidification and more frequent flooding are making it harder for families to live off the land. Even Gullah traditions, like basket making, may be in jeopardy. Nakia Wigfall says the fragrant honey-colored sweetgrass she uses to quell baskets is being destroyed, not just by development, but by hurricanes. The tradition was passed down from enslaved West Africans brought to the area for their ability to grow rice.
People shed a lot of blood and tears behind the baskets, and that's what I want people to know.
Then there's the language, a mix of Creole and English, created by slaves so they could secretly communicate. It has evolved for centuries.
Give them that one there. Give them that one there.
Sun Michaud is an artist and songwriter who learned Gullah at home. He now teaches a first-of-its-kind Gullah language class at Harvard University, sharing lessons on social media.
You know, the actual Gullah word for going is not gut, but gwine. Well, then who could be the one to tell him what gwine on?
Michaud hopes teaching the language will save it, but worries the loss of ancestral land may be too much for already fragile Gullah communities.
You don't want to say that it disappears, but let's be practical. As Gullah people go, so goes Gullah culture.
But he and others won't give up on a culture that has survived slavery. For Here and Now, I'm Victoria Hansen.
As several states throughout the country gear up for Election Day tomorrow, the state of Florida is dealing with a major fight over the rights of felons and their ability to vote. You may remember last year, Florida restored the voting rights of nearly 1.4 million felons. But then, this summer, a controversial state law was passed that requires felons first pay all of their court fines and fees before they can vote. A federal judge recently issued a temporary injunction against the new state law, but several organizations, including the ACLU, are now suing. We spoke with Pastor Clifford Tyson of Tampa, Florida, a former felon who is now a plaintiff in a lawsuit challenging the payments law. Tyson was convicted and served time for a felony armed robbery that happened in the 1970s. He says the death of his children's mother in the 1990s set him on a pathway away from crime.
I was always in the church because my father was a pastor, but I just came back. It took something tragic like that to lead me back to where I believed.
We start our conversation with Tyson about what it was like to vote for the first time after the law was passed at 63 years old.
I registered on the very day that I was eligible, January the 8th, I believe. I received my voter registration card 2 weeks later. I voted in the first primary locally, and it was my first time voting after 42 years. I was so happy. I took my 5-year-old grandson and my wife to the polls with me that morning at 7:30. And I wanted him to witness something that was important to me. And when they gave me my ballot, and there was only about 10 poll workers in there, maybe about two other people voting because it was early. And they told me to go over to the pick whatever booth I wanted, I started crying. And I began to cry, and one lady said, "Are you okay?" And my wife told them, "This is first time voting in 42 years. And so they began to give me an applause. And it was just that I didn't know it was going to be that emotional for me. And I wanted my grandson to see that, that his grandpa trying to get it right. And that's what I wanted him to carry on. So, yeah, it was a very emotional time.
So I can imagine when the secondary law was passed in July, really limiting the ability for felons to vote unless they paid all of their fees, that felt like a punch in the gut.
It was. It was like I had shackles put back on me, that it didn't matter. And what made it so bad, they did it not long after we got our rights restored. It was like, this is the avenue that we're going to take. We know they won't go win this vote, or they won this vote, and we're going to take these rights back. So, yeah, it was a punch in the gut.
A judge has since then issued a limited ruling that Florida cannot use a person's inability to pay fines as a reason to deny voting. But as part of this temporary ruling, if you are able to pay, though, you still have to pay. Tell me a little bit more about your lawsuit and what you're pushing for.
What we're pushing for is basically the 24th Amendment. I believe there's a clause in it that says a person should not be able to be denied the right to vote simply because they cannot pay. What's happening, there was never a system put in place in Florida to track, to know what a person has paid, what they owe. It was never put in place. So we've had judges, we've had lawyers, people, even election officials, who cannot accurately say what is owed. So if a group of 30 lawyers from Harvard to Notre Dame to Penn State can't figure it out, if judges can't figure it out, the average ex-felon who can't sometimes read his own name, how are they to know what they owe?
Yes, Florida has no centralized database where records for these court-ordered fines and fees or even payments of these penalties are stored. So to get that information, as you say, felons have to search on their own for documents. But it's even more complicated than that, because if you are not able to do that and you go to vote as a felon, there's a potential of you being arrested again. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Exactly. They're saying we can't vote unless all of our fines are paid, but our names are still on the roll on the voter's registration. So it's, what if we go and vote and then they got a "I got you" moment? You broke the law. Why should we help these ex-felons when they're continuing to break the law? And so I was in fear of breaking the law. And so many people who don't know this, don't know about governing, all they know is I'm still on voter registration roll. They don't really know that they could be breaking the law if they go vote.
Florida is a really important state because it commands 29 of the 538 electoral votes. And Florida has historically had tight elections and contested outcomes. Are you worried that you won't be able to vote in the 2020 presidential election?
It doesn't worry me, because right now the judge denied the state's stay because they tried to get a stay to let the law stay the same until they hear from the appellate courts. And so as it stands now, I'm able to vote without repercussions unless the higher court reverses the judge's decision and they rule in their favor before then. And so it's right now, it looks good, but it's still that chance that we may get different opinions.
I see. There are now four separate lawsuits, essentially calling this requirement for felons to pay fines a poll tax, which is basically a reference to an illegal practice of demanding voting fees. that have historically been used to limit Black Americans' voting rights. Does this feel like that to you?
Absolutely. You know, I had a granny who passed at 114 years old.
Wow.
Her name was Bama Tyson. She had 31 children. My dad has 16 brothers, 15 sisters. And I've heard stories about them putting on a Sunday best, going to the polls to vote. And when they get there, they're told, count the number of jelly beans mm-hmm. in the jar. They would make them do other things. So it's no different than the poll tax that they had back then that they're putting on us now. And it's and that's why this fight, to me, is personal. You know, I'm going to continue to, but I know I'm in it to the end.
What is next in this fight? As I said, as you mentioned, Judge Hinkle, he is the judge that made this temporary limited ruling that Florida cannot use a person's ability to pay fines as a reason to deny voting. But it's temporary. What's next mm-hmm. with your lawsuit and this push?
Well, right now we have a trial tentatively set in April of 2020. Knowing that even the state is probably appealing Judge Hinkle's ruling right now. So we're in limbo because they're going to try and fight this until the end. And so we're in for, we're nowhere near the end of this thing. And so we're going to continue to make people aware, to keep it on the forefront, to let them know not to give up on this fight and try and gather enough support because the people have spoken in the election. And that's why we have elections and democracy. And so we should be able to follow the rule of law.
That's Clifford Tyson, a pastor in Tampa, Florida, who is pushing for felons' rights to be able to vote in the state of Florida before the 2020 presidential election. Thank you so much, Pastor Tyson.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
And from Florida, we turn our attention now to the state with the highest incarceration rate in the country, Oklahoma, where today more than 450 people serving time for low-level drug and nonviolent offenses will be set free in the nation's largest single-day commutation in history.
One of President Trump's biggest legislative achievements is the huge tax cut that was passed by Republicans and signed into law in 2017. The president and his allies, including Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, promised that tax cut would boost the economy by as much as 6%, and
this will pay for itself with growth and with reduction of different deductions and closing loopholes.
Well, nearly 3 years later, neither has happened. Derek Thompson has been writing about this. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So President Trump and his advisors said that this tax cut would grow the economy. One measure of the economy, the stock market, is at record levels today. But you say we still haven't gotten the growth that was promised.
That's right. Republicans said that this tax plan was going to grow the economy by up to 6%. They said that lower rates on corporate income would stimulate business investment. And then, of course, you heard Secretary Mnuchin say that the tax cut would pay for itself. None of those promises are coming to pass. At the end of last week, we got a report from the federal government finding that GDP growth has now declined to less than 2%. That's a third of the growth rate that was promised by Republicans. And business investment now has actually declined for two straight quarters. It is nearing recession territory, and that is exactly what's driving down growth. So to be fair, the president doesn't control the economy. Congress doesn't control the economy. The economy is a $16 trillion animal that no one entirely has a leash on. But that is exactly why you don't make these absurd promises about the economic consequences of legislation that you are passing, because it almost never comes to pass.
Well, and what about the part about the tax cuts paying for themselves? That is definitely not true so far. The deficit, the federal deficit, is exceeding $1 trillion a year right now.
Yes, the federal deficit is now, I believe, at its highest point at any non-recession or post-recession time in American history. So it's not simply that the tax cut isn't paying for itself. The tax cut is now responsible for historic federal deficits. Now, again, another small caveat. You could argue that because we're in a period of low growth and low inflation, that it might be totally reasonable to run high deficits, and that high deficits might be good for putting money back into consumer pockets so that they spend. And indeed, we are kind of seeing this. The consumer is pretty healthy. Unemployment is low. Retail spending is still pretty healthy, and deficits might be a part of this. But again, it goes exactly against what Republicans promised when they passed the law. They said this is going to pay for itself. It isn't by any stretch of the imagination.
And it'll be interesting to see how much this comes up as we head into the 2020 campaign. What we are seeing already is that a number of the Democratic candidates have been releasing tax plans. When you look at those plans, whether it be from Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Biden or others, are they focused on just reversing Trump's tax cuts, or do their proposals go even further?
It's really interesting because you could almost say that the tax policies being proposed by the Democratic candidates are like a metaphor for the role they're playing in this campaign. So you look at someone like Joe Biden, who a lot of people see as presenting himself as a sensible, moderate alternative to President Trump, who isn't promising to entirely remake the economy. So what he's saying about taxes is basically, I'm going to roll back the corporate income tax that was voted on by Republicans. I'm going to raise corporate income taxes on large U.S. companies. But that's basically it. I'm not going to do a whole lot else. On the other hand, you have someone like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders who are promising something like Medicare for All, a multi-trillion dollar policy over 10 years. And there what you have are promises not just to put back corporate income taxes around 28%, but also higher income taxes on households in the 1%, a 6% wealth tax on billionaires, new capital gains taxes, and so on. And so it's just really interesting that with Biden, you essentially have him saying, I want to undo what President Trump has done. And then on the other hand, you have either socialist candidates like Bernie Sanders or social Democrats like Elizabeth Warren saying, I have a whole new vision for what the U.S. economy is going to be. And here I have a fleet of new tax policies to pay for that new vision.
Derek, whenever we talk about taxes, I think it's just worth looking back at the history in this country. When you look at how our current, after the Trump tax cuts, income tax rates and corporate taxes compare with where we've been in the past. Can you just remind us?
Sure. Basically, they're lower. Corporate tax rates have come down tremendously in the last 30 years, not just in the United States, but all around the world. And it's also the case that particularly for the richest Americans, marginal tax rates have declined in the last 40 years. And in fact, one of the biggest projects of conservatives in the United States has been to rather consistently reduce marginal tax rates on high income. So tax rates have come down, deficits have gone up, and there are some people who say that this is the beginning of a debt bomb that we're eventually going to have to pay for. I'm not sure that they're right if you look at inflation rates right now being relatively low, but it is generally the case that most Americans are paying a lower tax rate than they used to.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'll link you to his piece about the Trump tax cuts at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.